I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events, major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories, the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Mike, when you think of saints, who are some of the first people that come to mind?
Well, there's St. Patrick, St. Paul, St. Thomas, St. Francis of Assisi, Joan of Arc, Mother Teresa. I could go on all day, and I'm not even Catholic.
I was going to say, did you go to Catholic school growing up? Well, all those people seem to have one thing in common, aside from being canonized.
And that is?
They all lived at least 500 years ago, except for Mother Teresa, or even longer.
And your point?
Well, earlier this summer, Pope Francis and a group of cardinals approved an Italian teenager named Carlos Acutis as a saint. It's notable because Acutis died in 2006 at the age of 15. He's the Catholic Church's first millennial saint.
Wow. I'm Mike Rogers. That's Chris Blake. This is Something Offbeat. A millennial saint certainly qualifies. Now, to learn more about Acutis and the process of becoming a saint in the Catholic Church, I spoke with Dr. Kathleen Cummings, a professor of American Studies and History at Notre Dame, and the author of the book, A Saint of Our Own, How the Quest for a Holy Hero Helped Catholics Become American. Is it fair to call him the first millennial saint?
Absolutely, it is fair. And the reason, of course, is that most millennials are still alive. And the hard and fast qualification, one of the only hard and fast qualifications for becoming a saint in the Catholic Church is that you have to be dead. Because what canonization does is a long process that validates that the person, the holy person, is in God's eternal presence and has been so since the moment of their deaths. So that's what Catholics believe about saints. So most millennials are still very much alive. So yes, he is the first millennial to successfully go through this process.
This young man has earned the nickname, they called him God's influencer, patron saint of the internet. Tell me a little bit about some of the history of this. He died young, right?
He died very young. Yeah, he was about 15 years old, almost 16, and he had cancer. But another reason why not just millennials, but why young people who die young aren't often canonized as saints is because when you think about a trajectory of a life and in the Catholic Church, when you might distinguish yourself by living a holy life, most of the drama, most of that comes in midlife, right? So so it's rare for a young person to be known for really high levels of holiness. And so that was pretty distinctive about Carlo. In fact, his parents have said that it was Carlo who drew them to church, whereas usually for most people, it's the parents who are taking the kids to church. So Carlo had a strong devotion to the Eucharist, which is central to Catholic life. But what was distinctive about him is that he wanted to share this devotion and used the latest technology to do so. So he developed a website documenting Eucharistic miracles. He used the most available tools of communication to evangelize, to spread the good news. So he's informally called the patron saint of the internet. There actually is a formal patron saint of the internet. This is kind of one of these weird Catholic details. But in the early 2000s, Pope John Paul II put out a call for nominations for someone who could become the patron saint of the internet. And that process led to a saint called Saint Isidore, who was kind of an obscure saint from centuries ago, who curated knowledge. He collected knowledge.
Now, that detail is a little bit odd because St. Isidore lived nearly 1,400 years before the internet. He was the bishop of Sevilla in the year 600 AD, and he did create a school, and it became a model for future universities and wrote 20 books. which aimed to locate the origins of as many things as he could, like languages, science, and more.
It's kind of like Google before the internet, I guess otherwise known as an encyclopedia.
It was Google 1.0.
Well, according to the University of Portland, another possible patron saint of the internet is Saint Maximilian Kolbe, who built a media service to spread information around Poland in the 1920s. That's at least a few years closer to the birth of the internet.
So, have you ever heard of Saint Isidore? Most people haven't heard of Saint Isidore. So the idea that here is a person who is well-known and very relatable, especially to young people, could be the new patron saint of the internet. So that's where that comes from.
What exactly has to happen for a person to become a saint?
The first thing that has to happen is a person has to have a reputation for holiness, so much so that the people around them want to open a cause for canonization. That happened with Carlo very quickly. His cause was opened. He died in 2006. His cause was opened in 2010. Then testimony has to be gathered from people who knew him about the virtues he practiced. Did he live a holy life? That actually takes a long time. It moved pretty quickly with Carlo, but it typically takes a very long time. And then once a person is declared venerable, that's when that process is completed. And when the dicastery for the causes of the saints proclaims that indeed they lived a holy life, then it's time to watch for miracles. And after one authenticated miracle, and if you want, we could talk about the process of authenticating a miracle, a person is declared blessed. So they are beatified. That happened for Carlo in 2020. And then a second miracle, after a second authenticated miracle, then they are canonized. So it's actually one for beatification, one for canonization.
Who has the final say, the final thumbs up or thumbs down? That's the Pope?
Mike, I don't know about you, but the way you phrased that question gave me flashbacks to John McCain walking into the Senate chamber as they were voting whether or not to repeal the Affordable Care Act.
Or Siskel and Ebert with the thumbs up and thumbs down, right?
Exactly. So I guess that's the way the cardinals and the Pope decide on a saint.
With the Pope having the final say. I suppose that's just one of the perks of being Pope.
In the Catholic Church, that is always the Pope. But the heavy lifting is done by a part of the Vatican bureaucracy called the Dicastery for the Causes of the Saints. It used to be called the Congregation for the Causes of the Saints, but it was recently renamed. So they're the ones that do all the vetting, receive the documentation, that sort of thing. But the Pope has the final say, and the Pope will preside at his canonization ceremony.
So let's talk about the vetting, because you mentioned that, and this is something. There was a woman who prayed at Carlo's tomb, and her child was in the hospital and got better. That alone, just on the surface, that could just be a coincidence. There's got to be more to it than that. So they do some digging in the church, don't they?
They do some digging. So let's first talk about, there are miracles that happen for Catholic believers. There are miracles that happen all the time. Saints are invoked and miracles happen. Very few of those actually go through this process where someone who's in charge of a cause for canonization takes documentation about the cause, interviews witnesses, interviews doctors, very formal process, and then sends it to the Congregation for the Causes of the Saints to be authenticated. Once that happens, it's actually still a two-step process. There's a body of medical professionals, medical doctors, who review all the evidence, and they simply determine whether or not there is any scientific reason for the cure. And so in this case, it was a young girl in a terrible bike accident with the head injury. Her mother went to the tomb of Carlo in nearby Assisi and prayed that he would intercede for her to help her daughter heal. So what would have happened is the doctors would have said, we can't account for this. We can't account for her recovery. It doesn't make medical sense. Then it goes to a commission composed of theologians who then ask many more questions about whether, in fact, Carlo was the saint who interceded for the cure.
At the end of the day, when church officials make the determination of the Pope to, what winds up being more important, science or faith?
That's a great question. Faith, of course. This is all about faith. I mean, when we have a process like canonization, it's very involved, very legalistic. There's unsavory aspects usually involved in a cause for canonization. There are things that aren't holy. But in the final analysis, having saints and having saints from all walks of life, from all places in the world, is to give Catholics intercessors and models of what it means to live a life of faith. So it's actually interesting. Canonization doesn't change a thing about Carlo, doesn't move him to heaven, anything like that. Canonization just affirms that he has been in God's eternal presence from the moment of his death. So in that sense, the church canonizes people not for the sake of the saints themselves. They canonize saints for the rest of us, those of us who are trying to be saints.
Mike, I found the explanation of the process to be fascinating. I knew that Catholic saints had to be credited with performing miracles, but I guess I've never given much thought to what constitutes a miracle.
It is an interesting intersection of science and faith because you do have to vet every miracle, right? And it's not surprising that that would involve some sort of secular analysis.
And we do throw that word miracle around quite a bit in our culture.
Yeah, in the movies, there's the miracle on 34th Street. In sports, there's the miracle on ice and the Music City miracle. And songs about miracles by Kenny Chesney, Peebo Bryson, Barry Manilow.
You think the 1980 U.S. men's hockey team appealed to a saint before they beat the Soviet Union?
Given the fact that right before the Olympics, they lost to the Soviets 10-3 in an exhibition, I'd say they probably appealed to multiple saints.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events. Major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories. The unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
How many saints are there in the Catholic Church?
Oh, thousands, thousands. But in terms of only a fraction of those have gone through this formal process. So in the early church, and for the first millennia really of church history, saints were declared by popular acclamation. If there was a person who lived a holy life and was well known, they became a saint. The process really only started to be developed and wasn't entirely formalized until the 17th century. So since the 17th century, there have been a number of saints canonized, but that's a small number of people. The process has remained essentially unchanged, although Pope John Paul II revised it substantially in 1983.
So what changed?
Pope John Paul II canonized more people than all of his predecessors combined. He loved to canonize saints. He canonized 476 saints and he beatified 1,341 people, which means that they were well along in the process. So what that meant is his successors, Pope Benedict and now Pope Francis, have also canonized a lot of saints.
I suppose some people might say that he lowered the bar. Did he?
Some people do say that. They're wrong. He didn't lower the bar. What he did was make it easier for At the time he was Pope, most of the saints, the vast majority of the saints, came from three countries, from Italy, from Spain, and from France. And Pope John Paul II was the Pope of the global church. He traveled throughout the globe, and he wanted the canon of the saints to look like the rest of the church. So what he was known for was canonizing people from nations and places that didn't already have a saint. And a lot of those places didn't have the resources or the connections to get this very complicated process through. So he made it a little easier. The other thing he did, and this relates back to the miracle question, it used to be that you needed two miracles for beatification and two for canonization. He basically cut that in half. And yes, some people say he made it easier. But really, he was responding to modern science. In the 19th century, if someone was cured from cancer, you just say, wow, they're cured from cancer. If someone's cured from cancer today, you have to rule out every single experimental treatment that would have been done. The realm of what we don't know medically has shrunk. So therefore, it gets harder and harder to prove a medical miracle.
How many American saints are there?
Right now, there are 12, but it is such a recent story with the United States. And it's really hard to think about the United States as being without influence in the world today. But really, that's a fairly recent phenomenon. In the late 19th century, U.S. Catholics were growing very frustrated by the fact they didn't have a canonized saint. And 17 men and women from Central or South America, basically south of the Rio Grande, had already been canonized by 1870. And not a single cause from either the United States or Canada was even being considered at the Holy See. So this made them, kind of gave them a saintly inferiority complex. Like, we have holy people here too. So it's then that they started proposing their own saints. And you have to think about this a little bit. Proposing saints is actually kind of a luxury. If you think about the Catholic Church in the 19th century, composed mostly of immigrants, of very poor people, they're building churches, they're serving the needs of the poor. Canonization is kind of a privilege to spend time and doing that. It also requires, as I said, money and influence. So it took a really long time for Catholics to get their first saints. And when the first U.S. citizen was canonized, that was Frances Cabrini. She was canonized in 1946. She was actually Italian. She was born, it is true, she became a U.S. citizen, but she was born in Italy and remained kind of Italian throughout her life.
There's a Mother Cabrini shrine in the mountains outside Denver. I lived up there for quite a while. We used to drive past it all the time.
Cabrini was everywhere. There are actually three shrines to her in the United States. There's one in Chicago, which is where she died in 1917. And there's one in New York, which is where she first arrived on U.S. shores in 1889. And yes, she had foundations in Denver. Cabrini actually had 67 different missions or foundations on three continents, on Europe, North America, and South America. So even though the United States claims her as a saint of their own, of our own, she really was a global figure.
So what about the first saint born here?
So the first American-born saint wasn't canonized until 1975. That was Elizabeth Ann Seton.
Now, Seton was born in New York in the late 1700s and founded the Sisters of Charity of St. Joseph's in Maryland. That was the first community for religious women in the U.S.
Her miracles included curing a child of leukemia, a woman of cancer, and a man from a brain infection.
I want to get back to Carlo for 1 minute real quick. He is the youngest saint, I guess, most recently born and most recently died. But, I mean, we've seen over the centuries, this is an ongoing process. He's not going to be the last millennial.
I hope not. I hope there are some holy millennials out there right now.
I mean, is that going to happen? The young people alive today are going to wind up as saints?
We hope so. That's what we sure hope that is going to be true. But you're getting to an excellent point. It's no secret that the Catholic Church is worried about young people being increasingly disengaged from the church. The statistics bear this out. So listen, Carlo was a holy person. That nothing I say is going to change that. But it's also true that saints are canonized not only because of their holiness, they're canonized for their relevance. And Carlo's story is so incredibly relevant right now. He's a young person. My students at the University of Notre Dame, I remember in 2020 when he was beatified, they were commenting that, wow, he's wearing jeans and Nike sneakers. He kind of looks like us. This is something that the Catholic Church is counting on, that people who might be disenchanted with the Catholic Church for all sorts of reasons, we can name them, might say, well, wait a second, here's a person that kind of looks like me. Maybe the Catholic Church is worth staying in, worth looking at. So yes, that's actually the whole point of saints, that they draw people closer to God and to the church. And so with Carlo, the millennial and Gen X and on down are definitely a target population. When he's canonized, there will be pilgrims. Yeah, it'll be wonderful scenes of pilgrims coming from all over the world. And believe me, the Catholic Church will use those photographs as a sign that the Catholic Church is relevant for young people today.
You do hear that from the leaders of not just religions, but, you know, social movements, organizations, sports, team sports, that we got to get the young people.
Get the young people.
Gotta get the youth or we're gonna die.
Yeah.
I'm Mike Rogers, and thanks so much for listening to Something Offbeat. This episode written and produced by Lauren Berry and Chris Blake. Audio editing by Chris Blake. And original music by Myron Kaplan. And to keep listening, please subscribe to us on the Odyssey app, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you've got your own offbeat story that you think we should cover, we'd love to hear about it. Send it to us at somethingoffbeat@Odyssey. That's AUDACY.com.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events, major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories, the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.